Welcome to Outbeat Radio's special election year coverage. Thank you for listening. I'm Gary Carnevale here in the KRCB studio with my co-host Greg Moralia. We have the most informative show for you tonight. Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey will join us for a very special interview, during which we'll talk about her 10 terms in the U.S. House of Representatives, her support of LGBT rights, and her decision to retire. Later, we'll be joined by Dr. Ardell Thomas of the City College of San Francisco, who will help us wade through this election's initiatives. First up, it's Greg with Outbeat Radio News and Calendar.
Good evening, this is Greg Moralia with your Outbeat Radio News for Sunday, September 30th, 2012. Department of Homeland Security Secretary Janet Napoleono said Thursday that she will instruct immigration agents to consider same-sex relationships the same as heterosexual ones in determining whether an individual should be deported. Although the administration had previously told reporters and others that same-sex relationships will be taken into account when making deportation decisions, putting it in writing for field officers is considered to be an important change. The Department of Homeland Security released guidelines in 2011 and justices met to vote on which cases they'll hear this coming term. The appeal of the Ninth Circuit Court's decision about California's Proposition 8 was on the list of cases, but when the Supreme Court published the list of cases they did decide to hear, the Prop 8 case was not one of them. Tomorrow, the Supreme Court will publish a list of the appeals they are denying, and if the Prop 8 case is on the list, the decision of the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals will stand, and Prop 8 will be deemed finally and permanently unconstitutional. Marriage equality could be restored in California almost immediately. Now, there's some speculation that the Supreme Court will consider the Prop 8 case along with several other pending appeals involving the Defense of Marriage Act. In all cases, tomorrow will be a big day for the destiny of Prop 8. And speaking of marriage equality, Austin became the first city in Texas to endorse marriage equality, with a unanimous vote by the city council this last Thursday. The vote is purely symbolic, as the council has no power to change state law on marriage or enable any city to issue marriage licenses to gay couples. But simple symbolic acts matter, said City Council member Cheryl Cole. She wants city lobbyists to meet with state lawmakers during the next year's legislative session to discuss repeal or modification of the marriage ban. Council members compared the battle for marriage equality to the fight for women's suffrage and African-American civil rights, and equality advocates gathered at City Hall to support the council's move. Austin, the state capital and home to the main University of Texas campus, has a reputation for progressive politics, evident in previous actions by the council. It has banned anti-gay discrimination by businesses operating in the city and offered domestic partner benefits to municipal employees. The City of Austin Police Department recently became the fourth large police department to produce an It Gets Better video supporting LGBT youth. And here in California, on Friday, California Governor Jerry Brown signed a bill ensuring that single people and same-sex couples will have the same access to fertility services as those provided to opposite-sex couples. California is the first state to take legislative steps to reconcile the inequality faced by single people and same-sex couples who are seeking fertility assistance. The law removes a barrier that required women seeking artificial insemination from someone who is not an intimate partner to have the sperm tested with each new insemination effort, even if the mother had already been exposed to the donor's semen from previous insemination attempts. The policy was particularly hard-hitting for single women and same-sex couples who can now define a designated donor who can provide a fresh donation for each insemination attempt without having the sample frozen for repeated tests, thus reducing the likelihood of a successful conception. The new law will take effect on January 1st. Now here's your calendar of events for the coming week. On Tuesday, October 2nd from 10 a.m. until noon, the Napa LGBT Older Discussion Group will convene at the Queen of the Valley Community Center, 3448 Villa Lane in Napa. And also on Tuesday at 7 p.m., Out and About Santa Rosa, a social group, will meet at Aroma Roasters in Railroad Square. And on Thursday, October 4th, from 7 to 9 p.m., the Men for Men support group will gather at the Marin AIDS Project, 910 Irwin Street in San Rafael. And on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, October 5, 6, and 7, the final weekend of the Napa Valley Conservatory Theater's production of The Laramie Project, 10 years later, will happen at Napa Valley College. The new play focuses on change, hope, and healing a decade after the murder of Matthew Shepard. Tickets are $15 for students, seniors, and veterans, $20 for general admission, and you're advised to order them online at napavalleytheater.org. And on Sunday, from 1 to 5 p.m., the Food for Thought Sonoma County AIDS Food Bank hosts Calabash, a celebration of gourds and the garden at 6550 Railroad Avenue in Forestville. You can spend the afternoon enjoying local wines and gourmet food, touring the food bank's beautiful gardens, and bidding on gourd art by talented Bay Area artists. Tickets are $50 and are available by calling 707-887-1647. For Gary Carnevale, I'm Greg Moralia. Say it, say it, say
it. Tell it like it is. Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey was born in Seattle and educated at the University of Washington. After her move to California 40 years ago, she earned a living as a human resource manager and as a college professor. Congresswoman Woolsey entered politics when she was elected to the Petaluma City Council. In 1992, she was elected as the U.S. Representative for California's 6th Congressional District, which includes all of Marin and most of Sonoma County. She joined the Congressional Progressive Caucus and has served as its co-chair. She now serves on the Committee on Education and the Workforce and the Committee on Science, Space, and Technology. On June 28, 2011, the Congresswoman announced she would not run for re-election. Congresswoman Woolsey is joining us now. Thank you for joining us tonight on Outbeat Radio.
Oh, it's my pleasure, believe me.
I can't hear her.
You can't hear me?
Let's begin with a look back at the start of your time in Congress. What motivated you to serve in the often maligned branch of government, and what were you hoping to achieve?
Well, actually, I've always been an activist, and if something's important to me, I get involved in it, and my whole life has proven that. And I was at a point, Barbara Boxer, my congresswoman, was going to run for the Senate, and I was absolutely certain that education wasn't getting the exposure and the interest that we needed in our government, especially at the federal level. And so I decided I'd run for Barbara's open seat, and I won big.
And we're glad you did. You did win big.
Uh-huh.
You've always won big. It's often mentioned that you were one of the very few members of Congress who had received welfare. Assistance for those who require it from the government is a hot-button issue in this election. Talk about your experience as a young mother who required such assistance and how that would later affect your votes on the House floor.
Well, you see, I grew up in a very upper-middle-class family. My dad was a veterinarian. I married a man that was a very, very successful securities trader. We had three children, and he was emotionally ill. He wouldn't get help, and I had to take my kids, and we had to start a new life, and we did that. I went to work, and you know, I grew up in the 50s, so I had no intentions of being a working mother, for heaven's sakes. But I went to work immediately, but I didn't earn enough money in order to buy the shoes and make sure these kids had the food they needed. So I also went on aid for dependent children, but I was working the entire time. And it took 3 years for us to be able to work our way off of that. My children were 1, 3, and 5 years old at the time.
Hmm.
And what did that mean to me as a member of Congress, and to me first as an executive of a telecommunications firm? I was always fighting for the underdog and making sure that those that were earning the least got a fairer share of things. And we actually had in our personnel policies, as the human resources managers, we had we evolved. And 30 years ago, we actually had policies that established a non-discrimination employment policy based on sexual orientation. That was 30 years ago.
Mm.
So all of this that I had lived through, went through business. When I was on the city council, I helped start the first homeless shelter in Petaluma, and then as a member of the House, I knew that I just think our government main job is to help those who need a leg up.
Too few women serve in Congress. Tell us about your experience in the House, which is still sometimes viewed as an old boys network. How it has changed during your 10 terms, and why more women should strive to follow in your footsteps?
Well, actually, I was elected in 1992, sworn in 93. That was the year of the woman, you know. And the next election, 1994, the 17 women I went to dinner with, freshmen every week, out of that group, there was only four of us left. So you can see that women were the first to be sacrificed when things turned. It's better. It's easier to be a woman now because there are other women who will lead the way and will help raise money and who will actually adopt as a little sister one of the new members when they get there to help them through the morass. It's not easy. It's a man's world in this Congress still, but I decided that I'd learn how to play the political game and forget whether I was a man or a woman. And as I've never been a woman that thought I had to be a man to be successful, so that has helped. But I've never been a woman that used womanly wiles to get my way either. I just think you have to earn respect. It's hard for women in politics to raise money. It's still harder than for men.
Before we delve into LGBT issues, let's discuss your opposition to the Iraq War, which wasn't a very popular stance even among members of your own party. What was it like during those days after 9/11 when the war drums were beating and so few dared to join the anti-war movement?
Well, you know, it was so clear to me that it was wrong. And, of course, I was proven right. But I was the first member to have legislation brought to the House floor for a vote on Iraq. And my legislation told President Bush to bring our troops home from Iraq. And my own colleagues and even some of the most anti-war colleagues came up to me when we were debating that particular piece and said, look, don't call for a vote. We're going to be embarrassed. You're going to embarrass us. And I said, well, guess what? If I'm the only one that votes for this, I'm not going to be embarrassed. You figure out what you're going to be. And 138 members voted with me. And I think about eight of them were Republicans, if you can believe that. So that was the beginning of my colleagues knowing you can be against this war that you know is wrong and speak out and finally catch up with the nation. I mean, the American people have known it was wrong for a long time. And if you lead, people follow. And so it became very, very easy for me to know that I was bringing people with me when I with my stance. I've spoken on the House floor over 440 times. First it was to bring our troops home from Iraq, and now, of course, I'm working on Afghanistan. I didn't intend to speak on any issue that many times for 5 minutes, but we're still there, aren't we?
We are. I would like to congratulate you on your 100% rating from the Human Rights Campaign, which rates candidates according to their sponsorships of bills and votes on bills that are of concern to the LGBT community. You have for many years been a supporter of equal marriage rights for same-sex couples. Talk about voting against the Defense of Marriage Act during the Clinton administration and co-sponsoring during the 112th Congress the Respect for Marriage Act.
Well, it's never made sense to me why, when it's hard enough to find somebody that you're compatible with and can be a good partner with, that somebody else can tell you you can't love that person because of your sexual orientation. It makes no sense to me whatsoever. And I don't like unfairness, and I consider that a very unfair way to look at gay and lesbian people.
In the coming months, the Supreme Court may very well decide the fate of Proposition 8, which now prevents same-sex couples from uniting in marriage here in California. It is possible that the court may even make a ruling on DOMA, aspects of which lower courts have struck down. What are your thoughts concerning the Supreme Court's taking on marriage equality, and do you care to make a prediction?
Well, I think over time it's going to happen. I mean, there's really no issue of equality that's more important in our lifetime than and in our recent lifetime than equality of the sexes, meaning same-sex marriage would be the perfect example. But and I think it's going to happen. And the reason I know it's going to happen eventually is young people think this is the dumbest thing they've ever heard of, not being able to pick your own partner. When I go to schools, high schools, somebody will always ask me what I think about same-sex marriage. I will always answer absolutely truthfully that, you know, it's not up to us to pick somebody else's partner for life. And they clap. The whole auditorium claps. And these are high school boys and girls. They're with the program. It's just old, white-haired people like me that are having a hard time catching on in middle America, not particularly our people in our area.
Since 1994, every year except for one, legislation has been proposed in the U.S. Congress that would prohibit discrimination in hiring and employment on the basis of sexual orientation or gender identity. But every time it has failed to pass. Your support is clear. What will it take for ENDA to finally become law?
It's going to take a progressive Democratic majority. It's not going to happen with the Republicans, and it's not going to happen if the Democrats have a very narrow lead, a very narrow majority, because there's enough Democrats who will vote against it just because they come from ultra-conservative districts. So we need to happen immediately. Now, over time, it's going to happen because we're electing more gay and lesbian members. We're seeing their lifestyles. We're celebrating their babies on the House floor. And as I said, young people are not going to go into their adult life being all prejudiced against same-sex marriages. But we have to have a progressive Congress, and the grassroots is important in this. And gay and lesbian people who think it's okay to vote for a party that wouldn't stand up for them no matter what are making a huge mistake.
As a senior member of the Committee on Education and the Workforce, you've taken a stance against abstinence-only program funding for safe schools for all children, and against public schools that discriminates against students on the basis of actual or perceived sexual orientation or gender identity. Why is it still a challenge to require schools to educate children about sex in a realistic manner and to make schools safe for all students?
Well, you know, I think it's a control factor. I think that the right wing and people who have conservative religious views think that they can control the world if we control what we teach kids. I mean, abstinence only has totally been proven to be a total waste of money. Now, you could talk about it as one of the options when you're teaching sex education, but that's not the only option, and you certainly have to prepare kids to protect themselves if they're going to have safe sex, so that they can have safe sex and they can have sex that will protect them from disease. So, I mean, it's ignorance that keeps us from teaching our children what is going on in the real world.
And would you like to address bullying in schools? What can we do to stop that? How can we keep our schools safe for all children?
Well, it has to quit being ignored. See, I mean, bullying in general is something that has become too easy for adults to, oh, well, boys will be boys, and, oh, kids are mean, harsh with each other. They are, you know. But they are when their parents don't tell them that is, you know, that isn't how you treat another person. That isn't how you'd want to be treated. But it's really up to parents, and the schools can help, of course. And here in the North Bay, there's many anti-bullying programs in the schools that are very successful. And why isn't it a mandated? I don't know. It's not mandated because the federal government can't mandate. We can hardly mandate state by state things to happen versus school district by school district. But it's something that happens way too often that leaves a scar on people throughout their entire life. And for kids to bully gay and lesbian students is not okay. Those kids, though, quite often will have other friends, straight friends, that will stick up for them. But it should be something that's just you don't even think of doing because it's unacceptable.
Hmm. You're the co-sponsor of the Uniting American Families Act, which would allow U.S. citizens to sponsor their spouses for immigration purposes. This would remedy current laws that do not allow same-sex partners, even in those six states where such marriages are legal, the same rights afforded opposite-sex couples. Talk about this issue that is of such great importance to multinational couples.
Well, we had an experience in our offices with a lesbian couple that couldn't the immigrant member of the couple partner was going to be deported from the United States, and they had children together. I mean, they had their children, and it was so blatant that and for us to treat one set of immigrant couples different than others is again, see, there's Lynn Woolsey. Does not believe in unfairness. That's not fair. It's not right. It makes no sense. And if the only way to change it is to write a law and hopefully someday as soon as possible, get it passed, then that's what we have to do.
You've done such an incredible job for the LGBT community, and I want to thank you for that. You will be sorely missed. What made you decide not to run for re-election?
Well, you know, timing's everything. I'm a person that's had incredible success in my life, and I know when it's the right time to step aside, as I will. I knew when it was the right time to run for office, and this is the right time for... I'll be 75 years old on November 3rd, and... I'm tired of being on those damn airplanes, I'll tell you, every week. We go every week back and forth. Mm. And that's hard enough when I was 55 and first got elected. It actually didn't affect me at all. But now I want out of that. I want to be home more. I want to learn how to sit down for 5 minutes. But I'm president of Americans for Democratic Action. I follow in the footsteps of George McGovern and Hubert Humphrey and... Paul Wellstone and people like me. So I'll be busy. I'll have plenty to do. I just don't want to be putting my energy there anymore.
Hmm. Talk about some of the wonderful people, especially women, that you served with.
Well, you know, what I was going to say also, the only other woman that was president of Americans for Democratic Action was my mentor, Patsy Mink. I mean, we still talk about Patsy Mink on the House floor.
Mm.
People will say, well, who started, you know, who did all that for Title VIII? Well, or Title X. That was Patsy Mink. You know, she did so much. And she's an incredible woman. Barbara Lee is one of my best friends in the Congress. Only person that was brave enough to vote against signing a law that said we could go to war because after 9/11 that actually made it possible to go to Iraq. I mean, she knew it was the wrong thing to do. I knew the minute I voted that I'd done the wrong thing. Many of us did. But Barbara, she's going to be a world leader someday. You wait and see.
Hmm.
And Nancy Pelosi, the first speaker, female speaker, you don't know how hard that is. And I've never seen anybody work harder than she does ever in my life. Hmm. I've got lots of energy. Speaker, leader Pelosi never stops.
Hmm.
I don't know how she does it.
This is a very important election for the LGBT community, as well as the country and most likely the entire world. The next Congress could finally pass laws that would afford us true equality on many fronts. The next president may be in the position to appoint as many as 4 Supreme Court justices. Polls are indicating President Obama will be reelected and the Democrats will remain in control of the Senate. Who are you endorsing in key races this election and why?
Oh, golly. Well, I'm endorsing all the Democrats except for a few of the blue dogs that wouldn't vote with me if their life depended on it. I mean, I'm not against them. I'm just not putting my money or my name behind them.
Hmm.
But Tammy Baldwin is one of my favorite candidates for Senate.
In Wisconsin.
Mazie Hirono, Hawaii Senate.
Hmm.
And there's, of course, I'm fingers crossed, Jerry McNerney wins right here and over in the Stockton area.
Hmm.
And it won't be easy. I mean, those are going to be some hard races.
Hmm.
But, gosh, I mean, I've got so many that I'm supporting and have my fingers crossed for. And the two guys, the thing you have to remember about after redistricting, it's going to take 2 men to fill my shoes.
Hmm.
And I love to say that.
Yeah.
So Mike Thompson up north and Jared Huffman will get the Marin and coastal part of the district.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So, but they're both really good people, so we don't have to worry. We don't have to worry about them. They're going to do the right thing with LGBT votes. But you know, it's just I'm going to say it again. None of this will happen if we barely have the majority in the Senate because of their rules. I mean, it takes 60 votes in order to make anything decent happen, and the House has to be in the Democratic a good majority with a really good group of strong progressives.
Hmm. I recently saw Speaker Pelosi on a cable TV news show, and she expressed there was a real possibility the Democrats could take back the House.
Yes, absolutely.
Hmm.
About 4 weeks ago, I wouldn't have said that out loud, but I believe it, too.
Hmm.
So, but, you know, I'm going to, you know, this is the North Bay. We live in our own bubble.
We do.
And just because we have a majority of Democrats doesn't mean that majority of Democrats think like we do.
Mm-hmm.
And it isn't because they're bad people. They get elected by people that think differently than we do. And thank heavens we live here.
Mm.
I don't know. Well, I never would have lasted 2 terms with those in those other districts. But this is the best district in the country.
Mm. And you're the best congresswoman I personally could ever hope for.
Oh, aren't you nice to say that? Well, I've had a nice 20 years. It's been a real honor to represent this educated, caring, progressive district. I mean, I'm telling you, when I get lots and lots of mail, it's because they're telling me, thank you for doing the right thing.
Hmm.
And I'm not many members of Congress have that privilege, and I do. And that has made it possible, I'll say this if we have a moment.
Absolutely.
That has made it possible for other members when they think, people like me in Congress, whether it's whatever side we're on, because I like people. Hmm. You know, I don't go around being hateful. So they think that they can... They're insulting when they say, you know, Lynn Woolsey, she believes in a perfect world. And because I live in this district, I work for the people in this district, I can believe that because, you see, we all know if we don't try for a perfect world, strive for it, we're never going to get even partway there. And we aren't going to have a safe, secure world for our grandchildren and their grandchildren. We've got to get moving for the to do the right things. If that means perfect, have, you know, so be it. Let's work for it.
That's the perfect goal. Well, thank you so much for joining us tonight.
You're welcome. Thanks for having this great program.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure speaking with you, and we wish you the very best in whatever lies ahead for you.
Well, thank you. I figure I've got the fourth quarter coming up here.
Right.
So I intend to live it well.
Very good. Thank you again.
Bye.
Good night.
Good night.
We're going to take a quick music break, and we'll be right back with more. Stay with us.
Stand up for something, for it all.
And that was Justin Utley with Stand Up for Something. You're listening to KRCB-FM, Windsor, Santa Rosa. And if you're just joining us, you're listening to a special Outbeat Extra and our series wrap-up, preparing you for this November's general election. In the second half of the hour, we'll be talking about the state of higher education and how some of the propositions that you'll consider this November might impact California's community college system. And joining us in the studio now is Dr. Ardell Thomas, who is the department chair of the LGBT Studies program at San Francisco City College. Welcome.
Hi, Greg. Thanks. Thanks for having me. Greg and Gary.
It's great to have you back. You were with us a few months ago when we were talking about the LGBT Studies program
Yes.
and our partnership with Napa Valley College. And we've got some challenges facing you.
Yes, we do. At all community colleges throughout the state, and specifically City College, has been in the press a lot since July.
Yeah, let's talk about that a little bit. I mean,
okay,
a little bit about City College, though. I mean, it's the state's largest community college. I think the last time I looked, Santa Rosa JC here in Sonoma County has about 25,000 students. Napa Valley College, where I'm from, has about 6,000 students. But you're like closer to 90. Give us a sense of how big City College is.
At this point, we are around 90,000 students. In the past, we've been close to 100,000 on occasion. But 20,000 is a huge margin, but we've averaged pretty consistently somewhere between 80 and 100,000 students. I think, if I'm remembering correctly, we are certainly the largest community college in the state of California. We may be the largest community college in the United States.
Yeah.
I believe there's a school in Chicago and I think New York that come close, but I believe we're the largest.
And it's a multi-campus district, right?
Yes.
You've got how many different campuses in the city?
Well, right now, depending on how, there are campuses and then there are centers. So we have actual campuses that are devoted to City College 24/7, like our main campus out on Ocean Avenue, which is the original. And then some of our what are called centers are often middle or high school or church locations or other public spaces that City College of San Francisco rents.
Okay.
Part of why we do that, and this is also part of why we have such a big population, is that we really feel we are there and want to be there for all of San Francisco's citizens, all of them. And we really are the city's college, and we have been. We have been from inception, and certainly in the last, 20, 30 years when we've had the multiple campuses. It's interesting because one of the comments in the San Francisco Chronicle, but it came actually from our accreditation report, was that we seem to have too big of a heart, which we're actually happy about that, that we do want to be able to reach everybody with our credit and our non-credit classes.
Well, City College has certainly been in the news the last couple of months. Some positive stories, some negative stories.
Right.
You opened a new campus.
Chinatown.
In Chinatown. Mm-hmm. And then there's this issue about accreditation.
Right.
Do you want to talk about that?
First of all, I would like to say that the Chinatown campus had been underway. The ground had been broken some time ago. It's interesting. People immediately are like, well, now they've just opened a new campus, Well, that's been underway for a long time, and the funding and support for that had already been there. And we desperately need a campus in Chinatown. One of our largest groups of students are in the Chinatown North Beach area of the city. Many of them are older, and it's not that easy for them to go schlepping across town to the downtown campus or to the Mission campus or wherever. So that I would like to say that had already been well underway. The accreditation report is, there's, and there are certain things that I just, you know, I'm not at the right position to be able to address everything about it. I can tell you as a department chair, we are now truly having to put all of our student learning outcomes for all of our courses, for our departments, and for our programs out for full sunshine public view. And those student learning outcomes had actually already been there. If you were to go into all of our course outlines across the board at City College, you don't get a course outline through curriculum ever if you don't have student learning outcomes. So they've always been in existence. They just haven't necessarily been advertised in flashing lights. However, now anybody can go to www.ccsf.edu/slo and see every single department and every program at City College of San Francisco. There has been full work in all departments, cooperation from every department chair and from all faculty in all departments. What has been really interesting and good about it is we often, what people also don't realize is, you know, community colleges, we have a huge teaching load. And we love teaching. You know, we chose community college because we love teaching. I received my PhD at Stanford and chose not to go onto the research institution track, or as we used to joke about it, the proverbial Princeton job. There never really is a job at Princeton, by the way, where you can actually get tenure. That's probably not completely true. But I mean, my love is teaching. I also love research. So we know it's going to be hard work and a lot to do. But with that, we often as faculty don't have the opportunity to sit down and really talk and collaborate with one another. So in that way, this has actually been really great because we have started and had these conversations, not just within our own departments, but across the disciplines. I think that a lot of the financial morass that is going on is, I mean, look at the state budget. You know, that, and we're a huge school. We're a huge school, and we're in an urban setting that is incredibly expensive. Even when you're at poverty level, that's incredibly expensive in San Francisco. And that, you know, there are about 15 work groups. And forgive me, anybody listening, if it's more than 15, but I believe it's 15 work groups working toward the accreditation and how to rectify all of the issues that WASC, which is our accrediting agency, had with us. And things are going along beautifully. We have been, you know, on the department chair side and academic side of the house, we have been on time, if not early, with absolutely everything they needed and needed to redo. So I'm very hopeful. I'm very hopeful about it.
Great. That sounds really promising. But I know one of the programs that's potentially at risk because of the budget cuts, and certainly the one that's probably most interesting to our listeners, is the LGBT studies program. You know, it was the first of its kind in the country, and you won't find a more comprehensive list of courses offered by any college. Tell us about the threats you're facing as a department chair.
Well, just briefly, City College has a very different structure than most community colleges. And so we actually have our department chair council, which is a bargaining unit. And with each separate department, there is a department chair who oversees. We're unique because we are administrators, and at the same time, we're in the classroom. Therefore, we are the direct link between the students and between the other administration, the deans, the vice chancellors, the chancellor, and the board of trustees. In the summer, we had a call from the chancellor that we needed to add all of these sections, all departments, We had space. Let's add sections and let's bring more students in. And the department chairs responded, and within a week, we had all of those courses up and ready. So we are a very quick response team as well, which is really crucial. However, one of the ways that there are several ways that City College specifically is looking to cut money, and that makes sense. That was one of our accreditation issues, was the finances. One of the things on the table, and nothing is a done deal yet, but one of the things on the table was that those of us who are chairs of small departments, and by that it means you get one course release, three units, to chair your program, they are looking to have those smaller departments consolidate. And in so doing, it would mean that they would be able to reduce the number of department chairs who have the three units and our small departmental stipend. One thing that over the course of the summer that did not get reported was that the department chair council, we often have emergency meetings, and over the summer, we voluntarily took a cut to our stipends and have come back time and again to do that when we needed to. But the consolidation, two or three departments have actually voluntarily consolidated already. Where this gets tricky is with the departments that have all been born out of political struggle and struggles for equality. African American studies, Latin American Latino studies, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender studies, Asian American studies, Philippine studies, and the list continues, labor studies. And those of us who have come out of civil rights, United Farm Workers, the labor movement, the LGBT rights movement, etc., to create these departments and finally be able to have these separate programs, women's studies, coming out of the feminist movement, we feel it's very important while we actually work together and we have actually bonded together and we are now the Diversity Collaborative, but we find it really important that we do work together, but at the same time, if we were to consolidate, that we would lose the specificity and the specialness of what each of our programs brings. Now, my department's the one I can speak the best about. And if LGBT studies were to merge, let's say with women's studies, that's the one everybody says that, oh, that's a natural fit. There's a real reason that we've not done that, right? That we are not yet another gender studies program. And this is nothing against gender studies programs. But there's something about keeping it very specific, women's studies and LGBT studies, that we work together and yet we serve our students better by having the specificity of the separate program. And this past summer when I was at the LGBT Educators Conference in San Francisco, the national conference, it came up again and again that many department chairs and administrators and people running counseling services wished their school could have a separate LGBT studies program with a diverse set of offerings. For us, consolidation, we were the first in the U.S., you mentioned that, the second in the world. I still am working with research institutions around the U.S. and a couple of international schools on how to develop LGBT studies. I have a student this semester who is a pediatrician in South Korea, his home country. He got a special visa to come specifically to get the AA in LGBT studies at City College of San Francisco. He could have chosen another program somewhere else in the U.S. because now there are other programs. But we were the one he wanted to come to. So, I don't know if I've completely answered the question, but consolidation feels like going in the closet a bit.
Well, sure, because if you take away the name, then how's a student supposed to figure that out? If I'm going and I look at a diversity collaborative, that sounds great, but that doesn't tell me if I'm looking for a Latino studies program or a women's studies program,
right,
or in this case, an LGBT studies program. And I think you're right. We've spent enough time hiding and sort of masking what these classes are. It's time for them to be visible and to be able to stand on their own. And if it, that should happen anywhere, it should be in San Francisco.
Well, and I think, and I attempted to mention that the other night at the board meeting when we were discussing this. But I also think you're absolutely right. You know, this is 2012, and we have, and it's so significant, the first president of the United States, who's also our first African-American president of the United States, our first African-American Christian president of the United States, saying he supports same-sex marriage. That is colossal. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and then at the same time on a more local front, what if the first LGBT department needs to be subsumed into a larger cultural studies program? Now, we won't lose our major or our scholarships. It would just be under another program.
And hidden.
At the same time, I mean, we're all worried about that. Latin American Latino Studies is worried about that. They have struggled. They have one of the most comprehensive Latin American Latino Studies programs in the U.S., at City College, you know, and we've all, the good thing is we have all been talking to one another about this, and we're understanding that, you know, that these conversations are really important that we're having with each other, and at the same time, we need to continue to fight for autonomy.
Right.
I know community colleges and all state schools are threatened with funding cuts. Mm-hmm. And recently I read an article, I think, in the New York Times that talked about how it was easy to cut funding because there are so many for-profit schools. And certain presidential candidates have their hand in. And it seems around the country it's easier to cut funding knowing there are schools out there where loans are fairly easy to get, even though it's a higher interest and the dropout rate is much higher. And people are unable to pay those loans rather than fund public schools. I guess the question is, do you and does City College see that as a threat, as a factor in the budget cuts and in the other problems that you're facing?
I think that we are constantly being reminded that education is a privilege in the United States and not a right. And it should be a right. I mean, if I were running things, it would just be free. Because it really, to me, every day I walk in the classroom, I remember that in many ways the most radical thing I can do is teach. And that it should be open to everybody. We're in a system where throughout the U.S., we have some horrible tests, not just test scores, but people who've just, our high school systems are broken. Not just public and private. Hmm. And it's interesting to me because I have a unique situation in that I'm in San Francisco. We're an incredibly international city and I get a lot of international students. And time and again, the international students are so much better prepared than native U.S. students. But I think that this corporatization, I mean, again, this is my political side on this, of, you know, how much money can we raise while we're taking you to school? I think it's horrible. And every single person in this country should be able to go to college if they choose to do so. And to do that without having to spend the next 20 years paying back loans for that college. Even though California's just upped the community college rate to $46 a unit, we're still the cheapest in the United States. I mean, I'm not happy about the $46 a unit, but, you know, we're still one of the best gigs going. And community colleges are often places where you have incredibly rigorous and good education happening.
Well, and we've got just about a minute left before the end of our show already, if you can believe that. There are two propositions on the ballot that voters should be informed of, Proposition 30 and Prop 38. Both of them address funding issues with education in California. Proposition 30, I think the biggest difference is that it allocates money not only to K-12, which also needs help. Let's let there be no doubt about that. But it also shares some of that with the California Community College System, which, by the way, is the cheapest college system for providing broad-based education to a number of people in the country. And then Prop 38, which also increases taxes, but it devotes all of the money to K-12. So it's an important distinction, and if you care about community colleges, please pay close attention to Prop 30. Just a couple of reminders out there about the upcoming election. If you haven't registered to vote yet, you can do so easily online at www.registertovote.ca.gov. You can do it online. And the last day to register is coming up on October 22nd. And then be sure to mark your calendars for November 6th. That is Election Day. Polls open at 7 a.m. They'll stay open till 8 p.m. And everybody in this county needs to get out to vote and make your voice heard. Gary, this has been a great series working with you.
Thank you. It's been great working with you, too. And we want to thank our guests tonight.
Thank you.
Yes. Dr. Raldel Thomas from City College, San Francisco.
Thank you.
And Congresswoman Lynn Woolsey. What a treat it was talking to her, speaking with her.
And we'll be back next Sunday night at 8 p.m. with another edition of Outbeat Radio, Living Proof with Sheridan Gold and Dr. Diana Grayer. Thanks for spending your Sunday night with us.